enjoy that. And as I understand it, these slides, handouts, will be available to you on
They'll be on the website online.
Great. And we'll probably put them on. I can put them on mine, too, or email. Well, I can email them to you. I found that out yesterday. The slideshow is too big. Okay. It exceeds that limitation. All right. So let me just tell you what I'm hoping to do in the 15 minutes we have together. I'd like to tell you what compassion meditation is, what loving kindness meditation is, do a brief practice with you, because I think that's really the best way to understand what these modes of mindfulness are. Then I want to just quickly go over what we know now about the neurobiology of mindfulness meditation as a whole, and then contrast that with loving kindness compassion meditation, of which we know very, very little, but what we are learning is very exciting, well, to me. And if I do a good job, I'll spread the joy. And then just kind of wrap up with some conclusions. And it's timely that I'm doing this because I'm actually writing a grant to incorporate loving kindness into the work that I'm doing. And so my thoughts are wide on the issue because I've done so much reading and preparing now. And I'm actually trying to bring it together in a cohesive and coherent way. Of course, to sell it, to get a grant rate, but to make it make sense in a way that's meaningful and studyable, tangible. The good old operational definition of how are we going to measure what we're doing. So let me just start by sharing with you what compassion meditation is. Does anybody practice compassion or loving kindness? So a couple know. All right. So you have familiarity with mindfulness if you've been taking this class. Is there anybody that doesn't know what mindfulness meditation is? Okay, so compassion and loving kindness are enmeshed in mindfulness. But with compassion, the techniques are designed to help people develop a deep, compassionate, genuine sympathy for those that are suffering. That's the idea. And in Pali, the language of the Buddha, this is karuna, okay? A deep sense of compassion for those that are suffering. Loving kindness aims to develop an effective state of this unconditional kindness, love for all creatures. Okay, so irrespective of how much they're suffering, in other words, although the Buddha believed everyone was, so life was suffering. Okay, but this is metta in Pali. So you may have heard more about or read more about metta, but the two really are often practiced together. In fact, if we go into the research, what little's been done utilizing mindfulness, loving kindness, we go to Richie Davidson's lab, and this is a study by Antoine Letts, and they work with Mathieu Ricard, who's a Buddhist monk who has probably the most hours of meditation of any research subject that's in this field. And what he teaches to the subjects that are going to be coming in as the novices that get a 2-week practice in this kind of work is the short-term aim, folks, is to generate this unconditional feeling of loving kindness and compassion to pervade your whole mind as a way of being. Think of nothing else. No discursive thoughts. Okay. And the long-term goal, though, is altruism, empathy for oneself and others. And as the story goes in the ancient text, the Buddha was working with a group of monks. He sent them off into the wilderness, into the caves, to do their deep, mindful training. And they came back to him and said, "This is too scary. There's creepy crawlers out there. There's weird noises. There's things in those caves." And the Buddha said, "Then I will give you a practice that will keep you safe and that will remove your fear." And loving kindness meditation was born. And loving kindness meditation, one of the leading kind of Buddhist scholars is Sharon Salzberg. And Sharon Salzberg, here's the book I put the cover on for you, and I brought it because I wanted to share with you just briefly what she says about loving kindness. In her sense, it's a rich spiritual path that you embark on when you begin this practice. And the path begins with cultivating appreciation of our oneness with others through generosity, non-harming, right speech, and right action. Then, on the foundation of these qualities, we purify our minds through the concentration practices of meditation. As we do, we come to experience wisdom through recognizing the truth and become deeply aware of the suffering caused by separation and of the happiness of knowing our connection with all beings. The Buddha called this the Sure Heart's Release. So what is this? What are we talking about? What is this meditation practice? So I'm going to use an example by Chris Germer. Now, Chris Germer is another writer who's written quite a bit on compassion meditation. Here's one of his books that I thoroughly enjoy. This is Self-Compassion, and I've been reading this. This would be my goal with the women that I work with, to start to develop some self-compassion through loving-kindness training and the work that we're doing. But he has this wonderful website, and again, it's a dark HTML font, but you'll have the... and that's on your website. And what's nice about it is, if you are out there in the front lines of medicine and find yourself wanting to give to people you're caring for, there are oodles of these kinds of exercises that you can listen to or download. And you can tell your patients or clients to do the same. And Chris actually just wrote another book. It's an edited book. He's editing it. And many of us contributed, including myself and my research group here. And we're really excited. It's a compassion and wisdom and psychotherapy text. And we're just hoping that by making it, publishing with Guilford, not as a textbook, will get widespread. And the Dalai Lama wrote the foreword. So we're really hoping that it reaches far and wide, because it's a beautiful, beautiful text with so many people that contributed. So let's use one of Chris's examples and engage, if you will, in just a brief 10-minute exercise of loving-kindness meditation. So what I encourage you to do is find your meditation posture, as we are in this room, as best as you can. So, you know, if you brought a mat and you're a lie-down folk, we got a little room. Otherwise, use your chair. I'll do the same. And because I truncated the exercise for time, let me set this up. With loving kindness, there's a recitation that you're going to hear, and he's going to guide us through what it is we will be saying. But once you've achieved your meditation posture, then I invite you, if it feels right to you, to just close your eyes and to bring your full attention to being here in this room, feeling, if you're able, your body in your chair, or simply attending to the fact that you're breathing, you're here. Go ahead and take a few deep breaths as we wait for Chris Germer.
And now bring to mind a person or other living being who naturally makes you smile. Whenever you think about this person or living being, a smile naturally arises within you. This could be a child or your grandmother or a teacher, a mentor. It could be your cat or a dog. Or it could be a beautiful bird that visits you every morning. Whomever it may be that naturally brings happiness to your heart, bring that being to mind. And let yourself feel what it's like to be in that being's presence. If it's a bird on a limb on a tree outside, just let yourself feel the thrill of seeing that bird. Or if it's your child, how does it feel to be around your child or your grandchild? Or a spiritual guide. Whoever it is that makes you consistently smile, allow yourself to feel the good company. Savor the company. company of your loved one, of your dear one. And now, just for a moment, recognize how vulnerable this loved one is. And just like you, subject to sickness and aging and death. And also, just like you, this living being wishes to be happy and free from suffering. Just like you and every other living being. So, feeling our common vulnerability and wish to be happy and free from suffering, softly repeat the following phrases, feeling the importance of the words. May you be safe. May you be safe. May you be safe. And may you be peaceful. May you be peaceful. May you be peaceful. May you be healthy. May you be healthy. May you be healthy. And may you live with ease. May you live with ease. May you live with ease. Keeping your loved one's image in mind, savoring their good company, and also feeling the importance of your words, the truthfulness of your words. Your deepest wish, even though life is not necessarily safe or peaceful or healthy or easy, still we wish, you wish, for this loved one who naturally makes you smile, may you be safe, may you be peaceful, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. When you notice that your mind has wandered, return to the words and the image of your loved one. And savor the warm feelings that may arise. Go slow. At your own pace. May you be safe. May you be peaceful. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. Expand the goodwill that you have in your heart to include yourself. So put your hand over your heart. Feel the warmth of your hand. Just kind of tuck yourself into that goodwill. Snake yourself in. May you and I both be safe. May you and I be safe. May you and I be peaceful. May you and I be healthy. May you and may I live with ease. May you and I be safe. May you and I be peaceful. May you and I be healthy. And may you and I live with ease. So visualizing the image of your loved one and holding your hand over your own heart, hold both of yourselves in goodwill. May we be safe. May we be peaceful. May we be healthy. May we live with ease. Though life is not always safe, may we be safe. Though we are so often not peaceful in our hearts, may we be peaceful. Though health and sickness come and go like day and night, may we be healthy. May we live with ease. Finally, once again, visualize your whole body in your mind's eye. See your whole body in the current posture that you're in. And holding your hand over your heart as an expression of natural goodwill, of our innate goodwill and the goodwill of all beings to be happy and free from suffering. We're just trying to find words for this most basic desire of all living beings. And noticing any stress or uneasiness that may be lingering within you, either physically or emotionally. Recognizing your wish to be happy and free from suffering. Offer kindness to yourself. May I be safe. May I be safe. May I be safe. May I be peaceful. May I be peaceful. May I be peaceful. May I be healthy. May I be healthy. May I be healthy. And may I live with ease. May I live with ease. May I live with ease.
Okay, when you're ready, bring your attention back to being in the room. Take a few deep breaths. Opening your eyes. Spend some more time together. Talk about some neuroscience now. Anybody want to take a moment for some inquiry and share your thoughts about that experience? Please come in. There's plenty of seats.
I naturally wanted to expand it for myself to other people. You can see expanding it to the whole world.
Some of the teachers of loving kindness find that it's often hard to get people to start with themselves. That would be the last thing they would do. We're talking about that in our work with addiction, that getting to the self-compassion part may be the very last hard thing to do, and start with putting out the positive energy, not only people they love, but the whole world. would be an easier way to go. Other comments? All right, so again, if you came in possibly a little late and missed that, lots of those exercises on Chris Kirmer's website. Even though he's a widely published author, he just is very generous with all of those things, which is great. So the rest of the time that we have together, I'd like to talk about the brain and what's happening in the brain, the so-called mindful brain. Before I get started on talking regions and science, would you mind showing me, show of hands, how many of you have had advanced formal training in neuroanatomy? I mean, I'm seeing scrubs and such, so we got a few. Then the rest of you, no, not neurosurgeons or neuroscientists, just genuine interest. Okay, so we have a kind of diverse group. So hopefully I won't put to sleep the surgeons as I digress as needed to point some things out on my lovely brain model. But you can enjoy the colors then. Okay. All right. So what I'd like to do is, as I said, first I just want to talk a little bit about what is it we know about mindfulness meditation at the neurobiological level. And I'm going to be talking some of what just came out in Britta Hotzel's paper. If you follow this field, you know that Britta Hotzel and Sarah Lazar. Britta is Sarah's postdoc at Harvard, and they are really leading the way and just trying to synthesize the research, even though they're doing some of it. I've met these folks at the Center for Mindfulness conference where I give a workshop on the neurobiology of mindfulness as a primer for therapists, and it was a real honor to have Britta there, and we've communicated since on just a sharing of ideas of synthesizing what it is that people are finding in individual studies. So this is right out of, I'm really so excited for it because it's Perspectives on Psychological Science, the APA, or APS journal. So you can check that out afterwards if you want. And you're at the UW, so you have ready access to all these wonderful resources. Okay. So what I want to do in doing an overview first of mindfulness, I want to talk first about what's happening in the prefrontal region, the prefrontal cortex. So here on my brain model, if you can appreciate, there's obviously a very distinct orange band, then there's some yellow, and then there's peach, or this neutral color, and I'm really going to be focusing in first on what's happening there, okay? And I'm only going to talk about the regions that have been implicated in mindfulness, which really doesn't do justice to the prefrontal cortex, but I have to. We don't have enough time. I could literally spend, well, normally this workshop's 3 hours, and then I could spend at least a whole quarter on it, so I'm going to talk really fast. Beyond that, I want to talk about the cingulate cortex, which lies, let me go down the, so I'm going to take a cut through the middle of the brain here, and this would be the midline sagittal plane, okay? And that orange band of tissue that you see above this white band, if you can appreciate that, this is, looks like it's fibrous in nature. That's the corpus callosum that connects the two hemispheres. I want to talk about this orange band of tissue, and I've drawn it in there that way. And we're going to talk about this most anterior portion and the posterior portion, ACC, anterior cingulate cortex, PCC, posterior cingulate. Then, looking laterally, along a major fissure, it's a longitudinal fissure, okay? I've drawn it here. I want to talk about two regions on this, what's called the temporal lobe. Your temporal lobe is literally, if you go in and you tickle your temples right here, you're going in there to the most anterior portion or rostral portion of the temporal lobe. Okay. Talk about this inferior temporal gyrus, okay, and the temporoparietal junction, which literally is supposed to be where the temporal lobe meets with the parietal lobe, okay? So we'll talk about some of those regions there. I'm actually going to be talking about the cerebellum, which is a kind of new development. For a while, people have been talking about the cerebellum being involved in coordinating emotion, and some people have been very skeptical of that, and yet the data is building, and there's some neat stuff happening there. The insula is probably one of the areas that's going to be most interesting to us as I end the talk with loving-kindness meditation, amygdala in the temporal lobe and the hippocampus. So we've got a lot of ground to cover, but what we'll see as we look at what we learn in the neurobiology of mindfulness is there's, across studies, multiple studies are finding research or changes in individual areas. So, this is not projecting as large as I had hoped it would, so I'm going to just have to do my best to read this to you. I just want to give you an overview of what these regions do. And again, this is for a simplification, and it's purposeful, my purpose in the story that I'm going to tell you. Okay, so neurologists in the room, cut me just a wee bit of slack, or extend grace, we would say, okay, in my field. Because it obviously these regions not only are interconnected, they do multiple things. But I think it's important that this orbital frontal cortex is what the OFC stands for. So what am I talking about there? Orbita, well, right above the eye orbits then. So you're looking, if I turn the brain over, this is what we would call the ventral surface. I'm not going to try to put this thing together. It's sticky. Right about here. Okay, so right above your eye orbits. Okay. The orbital frontal cortex, very important for cognitive appraisal of emotional stimuli. Emotion is going to be kind of a common theme with these regions. Also important for behavioral inhibition. In a paper that I just wrote with colleagues looking at how does the neurobiology of addiction map onto the neurobiology of mindfulness so that we can begin to talk about how mindfulness may help addicts. The fact that we're seeing change in the orbital frontal cortex, which is profoundly important for behavioral inhibition, is of interest to us. Okay. The ventral medial. Okay, so again, the ventral surface. Okay. I guess I better put it together. I don't think I need the midline sagittal plane again for the few minutes. Okay. All right. Okay, I'm going to talk about this region here. So this would be analogous to when we talk about right between the eyes. You know, right between the eyes. What is that? Now, I'm really reducing this, so I will talk a little bit more. But this region has been implicated in a very simple kind of learning, a conditioned learning. Okay, a paired associative learning, and it is very important for extinction processes in learning. And if you lesion this in animals, you can't extinguish a paired associative type of behavior. That, too, is going to be important as I'm going to talk about things like conditioned anxiety. So the fact that we're seeing change there is important. Up on the dorsal, so dorsal, okay, and then off to the side, lateral, okay, dorsal, lateral. Radial appraisal of these aversive stimuli, so evaluating and reevaluating. Now, if we go into the cingulate cortex, again, keeping with the emotion theme, which is going to be really important, the cingulate, particularly the anterior cingulate, is really important for us with this thing called conflict monitoring, as we're getting these major streams of information coming in that conflict with one another. How do we assess all of that? Especially if those things are affect-related, mood-related. It's also going to help us with our executive attention working with the prefrontal cortex. So streams of information coming in, it's affective related, what's important to attend to, okay? Very important cortical processing of emotion, including, and this is a recent finding I'm going to show you briefly, the study that revealed this in part, attending and empathizing with another's pain. And this is going to be related to our loving kindness meditation, which we just did. On the posterior end of the cingulate cortex, this is getting a lot of interest in an area of neuroscience where people are investigating something called the default mode, the default network, what our brains are doing when we're not really attending necessarily to anything. It's active, as you see, with self-referential processing, okay? Our autobiographical thinking, the stories that we tell ourselves. By now, I've been talking, well, we ended our meditation at 20 after. I've been talking for 10 minutes. You've probably left this room mentally 3 times, okay? Where else were you, and what else do you want to be doing, and what are you thinking? You're activating that part of your brain. That's the default mode. That's what your brain does. The brain is always working. It's never not working, okay? And so because of that, it's often creating stories, and we can get caught in those stories. Mark Twain wrote that much of my life is full of misfortunes that actually never happened. You know, we get caught in the stories, and before we know it, did I dream that? Did that really happen? Did I do that, or did I dream that? Okay. All right. Lost my little clicker. Okay. Cerebellum. There's just plenty of data now to suggest that this also coordinates emotions, not just movement. Okay, and we're learning some interesting things about adolescence and how the cerebellum can continue to develop, and it might explain why adolescents are kind of emotionally awkward, because these regions are still developing in their young brains, and we use our cerebellums to help kind of coordinate emotional responses. Some really neat stuff out of McLean Hospital with Deborah Yergelin Todd on that, as well as the reference I'm providing there. Then in the temporal lobe, we've got the anterior temporal, so this gyrus up here, the TPJ. These two regions are implicated in spiritual experiences. Andrew Newberg's done some interesting work with these areas here and up in the posterior area. It's that sensation that some people can have in a deep spiritual state where they almost lose their skin. They lose their sense of disconnect with the rest of the environment around them. Now, I'll share that with psychologists, and they all get very anxious. Wait a minute, that's disassociation. We don't want that, right? You can't get them back in the body. But it turns out that deep mystics and spiritual experiences, this is something that comes and goes, and they do get back in the body, but it's a profound experience. And when he's shown that it with functional MRI, these areas are lighting up. But in addition to insight, I also want to point out up here that Antoine Lutz, the group out of Richie Davidson's lab, have also shown this region to be important for attuning with other people's emotions. So this attunement piece is going to be important for where I'm headed. And then the insula. Where's the insula? Okay, the insula, can't show you exactly on my model, but if I had, would be G my insula here? Wouldn't mind now because I teach women's health. If I had a speculum and I could separate the sulcus along the longitudinal sulcus that separates that temporal lobe from the parietal and go in there and spread that open, there'd be an island of cortex in there. So to the anatomist that first saw that, oh, it's an island of cortex. It's an insula. So it's the insula cortex in there. And I remember when I learned neuroanatomy, learning about the insula, I was like, yeah, there it is, isn't that cool? We have no idea what that does. But today I get to teach about empathy for others and awareness of our own internal states, something called viscerosomatics and interoception. I mean, if you really thought long and hard enough, some of you might actually be able to count your heartbeats by just feeling it in the chest. Most of us need to find it in pulse places, okay? You can think internally about what the GI system's doing and really spend some time really thinking about that. Don't, because that could either make you hungry, and I won't do the bladder because you'll all have to pee. I like to do that to my undergraduates just because I can. And then the amygdala is important for emotional processing, as we all know. It plays a role in fear, plays a role in stress, because now we finally have event-related potential data from people who have actually implanted electrodes, kind of as a pre-op assessment of where a seizure locus is. That data, because they were willing to undergo some experimentation while they had this stuff in their head, has taught us that this area of the brain really plays an important role of pre-processing of all emotion. Fear, yes, gets the highest signal, but happiness, sadness. So that means our emotions are on some sort of continuum with stress and fear. And I think that's important and meaningful. Okay. All right. So, did I miss one? Oh, thanks. Memory. And then I'm going to move on. Okay. I want to share with you, how do we know some of this stuff? I'm actually obligated, of course, to do that in the classroom. How do you know? But this is important. A sample study with mindfulness. Obviously, I can't show you all the research that I just referenced in there. But let's go to Norm Farr, postdoc in Zindel Siegel's lab at the University of Toronto. And he used fMRI. To study what he is talking or referring to is two modes of self-reference, the narrative me and the experiential I, okay? What he did was he took two groups, a weightless control group, this is the novice group, and the MBSR grads group, okay? So MBSR, anybody not know about the mindfulness-based stress reduction program? Great, so they had just finished that. Into the scanner they go, and their task while in there in this functional paradigm is, you're going to see a series of words that are trait-related adjectives. And your job while you're in the scanner seeing these kinds of words is first to obtain a narrative focus. I want you to look at this as a me and tell me my story. Charming. Oh, yeah, I remember when back in eighth grade people used to write in my little book, you know, my yearbook, how charming I was and how lively. My mother always says I'm so hopeful. So you can see that what they're trying to do is try to entrain that self-reference default kind of mode network by doing that. And then here with the experiential focus, this is your mindfulness task. This is present moment, right now, current, I. See the word hopeful. Do I feel hopeful in the present moment? Lively. Do I feel lively in the present moment? Attend to it and try to attune with it. I am lively. Okay. Now here's what they're finding, consolidating their results. Here's with the mindfulness, the experiential focus. You're really probably not able to see this, but this is the midline, not quite, but midline central plane here, posterior cingulate cortex, the ventral medial prefrontal cortex. We're going to take a coronal section, which is what this shape looks like, frontal section perhaps, right here. We're going to look at the structures using fMRI analysis to look, of course, at bulb signal or the signal activation. And then they did some interesting interconnectivity analysis, and here's what they find. In the novices, okay, with experimental focus, there's this connectivity or high correlation, 0.61, between the insula and the ventromedial PFC, whereas in experts, well, grads of MBSR, there's a decoupling. You lose that relationship, okay? So the connection between the insula and this part of the brain is separating, okay? But look what happens for your mindfulness folks down here. What they do couple their insula, the empathy region, with is the lateral part. So they've left kind of the medial processing of this attending to internal body states, empathy, insular region, medial processing, and gone lateral with mindfulness. What does that mean? Well, that's where you have to go to literature and say, what does that mean? How does one explain these findings? And they suggest that this activity pattern is associated with a detached or objective mode of self-reference, okay, because going lateral is tapping that default mode network, okay? Now, what do we know in terms of mindfulness? I want to talk about these regions and what have we learned in terms of structure. I've just put in here green, and everywhere you're going to see me click, what these boxes are basically saying is all of these regions are showing gray matter increases in expert meditators over and above novices or mindfulness-based stress reduction grads over and above novices. This is kind of interesting because what that's saying is something's happening in 8 weeks.
And I'm sorry, did you say activity?
No, this is structure.
This is structure.
This is structure. Yeah, look at where you are. Okay. I apologize. I usually have a big screen. But it's gray matter increases. So this is voxel-based kind of morphology, MR, structural data. And it's... this is interesting to me because you have five regions that are showing increased gray matter in response to like 10 to 50,000 hours in experts. I mean, you would kind of expect when Sarah Lazar first published those data, okay, yeah, these people, plus you have to consider they have interesting lives. If you had that many hours a day to meditate, you probably are not as stressed as how many of you said you were physicians? I don't even want to look at your brain. Okay? But then, so they're still confounding. But then they did these 8-week MBSR classes, and we're seeing change in five regions. They're not exactly the same regions, but it's not just the hippocampus where you would expect some kind of neurogenesis pop, probably something happening there. So this is just profoundly interesting, and as a student of neuroscience, I've never seen this before. And all the different things I had to study, the graduate training and the 18 years since, you just don't see this much change with a behavior. Well, maybe it's not just a behavior. Yeah.
I assume somebody's done a pre-post study.
Yep. Yeah.
And does that...
Yeah, they're the 8 weeks. Okay, so the 8-week MBSRs are the pre-post.
Okay.
Anywhere, when you look at the handout, anywhere you see an expert meditator to a novice, no. These are going to be people that have gotten these major monks and meditators and just looked at them and compared a matched control as best they can. Right. Now let's look at functional data. Okay, now where you're going to see these blue boxes appear, what these are basically saying is when you stick somebody in a scanner and you measure brain function, there's increased activity in these areas. So you're turning on the brain and you're structurally changing it, bottom line, in areas that are implicated in emotional processing and emotional regulation. What do we know about loving kindness meditation? Very little. This is a brand new area to look at loving kindness meditation. So I'm going to show you one of the sample studies from Antoine Lutz's lab, okay, or it's actually Richie Davidson's lab, but he's the postdoc that's doing all the scanning work. Okay, and he studied fMRI responses during compassion meditation. So he took two groups. He had experts, all right, 10,000 plus hours. In his group, mind you, is that Mathieu Ricard, who I mentioned earlier, and then novices who Mathieu trained for just 2 weeks. So these novices get these two weeks of doing exercises similar to what we just did. They go into the scanner, and their task in the scanner is, well, we're going to watch your brain while you hear... okay, a negative emotional sound. That's my oldest when he's alone. Aw, I should get an aw. Thank you. Okay. So old now, it just kills me. Okay, so, and here's what they find. Well, I should say, among their findings here are some. Greater increases in the insula in experts. Greater increases in the TPJ in experts. The greatest increase when they hear negative sounds. But across the board, experts show greater activity with all sounds, with all the emotional sounds. And they're suggesting then, well, this area is important for empathy, spiritual experiences and attuning. Something about practicing this for all of those hours is allowing them to attune and resonate with that emotion and generate a genuine empathy. Can this practice create a higher level of empathy and compassion? And if in fact that is true, then, if you're turning on these regions, okay, these regions where we see increased function, here's a few regions we see increased function with mindfulness. We see increased function with loving kindness. My purple boxes are the ones that will increase with loving kindness. This region, emotional processing, okay, very important for extinction processes. Now that's interesting. So you can turn on an area of the brain that's going to allow you to extinguish a negative condition kind of situation like a conditioned anxiety. So what if you come home from Iraq and every time your neighbor starts the car, you're having a conditioned response? Are you saying then that by training this circuit, you could somehow extinguish that condition in animals? That's what Joseph Ledoux shows. And of course, now his work's been extended into humans with those memory replacement studies to get rid of these conditioned anxieties, and they're tapping the ventral medial PFC in doing so. Function with loving kindness in the rostral. Anterior, or the right, sorry, right anterior cingulate, anterior and rostral redundant. Okay, we saw that with mindfulness. What is that born for? Executive attention. Okay, so we're really going to attend to things coming in. Conflict monitoring, especially with affect-related things coming in. So emotional stimuli is coming my way. I gotta filter through the strings of all that's coming, what's important, okay? And empathy of another person's pain. Let's move on. The insula, we get activity there just like we did with mindfulness. What was that for? Empathy and awareness of our own internal states. Okay. TPJ. Okay. And now we're seeing the hippocampus for the first time. And you remember TPJ was spiritual attuning. Now it's in the hippocampus for the first time. Is there something about loving kindness meditation that's going to not only entrain circuits that are going to allow us to resonate and attune? What if that's with myself? Apply compassion, find this to be important, extinguish associations that perhaps are negative, and then entrain new memories? That becomes my memory? Is that even possible? Okay. It's been suggested that, looking at time, I won't take time to read that, but it's been suggested that by Buddhist psychologists and practitioners of these things for the long term, that you can touch with the heart in these practices what you've previously touched with the earth. And what you practice for yourself becomes your nature. We talk about the Buddha nature. In other words, what if we were to apply that loving kindness to somebody we just really don't like? You've got one of those, don't you? They're called mother-in-laws. Sorry, did I offend? But okay, so somebody, and you've practiced and you've opened your heart, you're feeling very loving, and then you turn to the rat. May the rat be well. May they be safe. But then with practice over time, when we engage that person or see that person as the first thing then that could come to mind, may you be well. Okay. One of the reasons we believe that the Dalai Lama wrote the foreword to the book was in his Seeds of Compassion towards what he's hoping for is that through practices like that we can become a more compassionate people. That, yes, we have difficult relationships. Rats exist. But through training, maybe what we can train, what we do is what we practice for ourselves. And if the neuroscience supports that, if we start to see more studies with gray matter change in response to these things. Now, what's the big question there?
How to improve?
Well, yeah, there's always that. We got to get beyond that. But is it functional gray matter? Right? Is it functional matter? And I think that's what we need more of, more studies that align the anatomy with the function. So that I end on time, 50 minutes. We got to get people out of here at 10 till. Okay, well, at least then I have time for questions. What are my conclusions as I look at these data? I have a lot, actually, a lot of thoughts. Because like I told you, I'm writing a grant. But, I mean, just across the board, what do we see? Loving kindness, we see less widespread neural activity, or said another way that's a more of a selling feature, it's more specific, it's more specialized in certain regions that are profoundly beneficial, potentially beneficial. There's no structural data with loving kindness meditation yet. Okay, we just don't know. So all that structure I didn't even include when I added the loving kindness in. But there is focused activity in the insula, so that which plays a role in empathy and our internal feeling states. There's focused activity in the VMPFC, the ventromedial prefrontal, but without decoupling of the insula. If you think back to the study that I showed you from Lutz's work, he showed that experts decouple their insula. They kind of have this detached mode of self-reference. Therapeutically, can't there be situations where we don't want that to happen, where we want people in the body, really resonating and attuning, and then applying compassion, self-compassion to the situation, rather than detaching? I think it's interesting that we get that very separate kind of thing. Can we inhibit conditioned learning associated with these internal states by activating that PFC? That has implications for addiction. Anxiety. Now, I'm not a clinician, so we know what we know, and that's really all I know. That's what we, you know, and I only know it in women, so I'd have to start talking estrogen and progesterone to have it make sense. All right? But also the issue of self-compassion. This is the avenue I want to go with the women. I think we've become so disembodied that and so detached that getting back in the body, getting healthy in the body, and finding that self-compassion. Of course, I was just teaching about eating disorders yesterday. And that's just a scary topic to teach about anymore. And I just wondered what degree developing a program of self-compassion and really get tuning would be helpful. And that TPJ, attunement, okay, and spiritual experience. Now, a lot of people are steered away from mindfulness, you know, in the day because, oh, well, I can't do that meditation. So I'm Catholic. That's, like, against my faith. Or, you know, the opposite is, like, that sounds like wishy-washy prayer-like stuff, and I don't want to do that. So having a variety of choices for people for practices could just allow for serving more individuals out there. And some people actually navigate towards wanting a rich spiritual experience, okay? A lot of us in psychology have questioned whether Maslow had it right, and maybe the pyramid should be flipped, okay? That the spiritual needs shouldn't be at the very top after everything else gets met. That we have a deep-seated need for spiritual wellness. It's a part of who we are. And call it whatever you want, whether there's a deity involved or not, but it's there and it's rich and we need, okay? All right. But I guess in the 60s it was just radical to even suggest people had spiritual needs. So good going, Maslow. All right. And the hippocampal activity may lead to more favorable memories. So, folks, I did a Medline search for this in my work, 8 published. The world's our oyster. Okay. Thanks. Question? If you have time, or if you have class at 1, you need to run.
I read one article, I don't remember where it was now, but it was loving kindness meditation, and it showed, they did some psychological tests, and it showed that people approach things in a more positive fashion after 8 weeks. Does that, to you, does that show, is that correlated with any?
Yeah, I believe what you're talking about is Richie Davidson's study, and he did it with John Kabat-Zinn, and what he was using was EEG, and he found that it favored the left over the right activity, and that activity correlated with their self-reported desire to engage even difficult situations, when the tendency typically is to activate right and retreat from difficult situations. And so something about mindfulness says, let's go forward. Yeah, it does. I'm presenting in next month our heart rate variability data, and we're actually showing that mindfulness-based relapse prevention produces an increase in high-frequency heart rate variability during a stressor. And that's just amazing to me, because that means that something that we're teaching these people is saying, go into a stressor with vagal tone. Bring your, whatever it is, mindfulness, your capacity with you into a stressor situation. Don't retreat from it, and don't slam on the brakes, which would take PNS tone away. Go forward. And like I said, I haven't looked at the fMRI data, so I don't know, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we'll find common pathways that other folks are finding.
Is this heart math? Just a bit.
Is
this heart math?
Heart math?
Yeah, what you're looking at.
No, what we did was I subject people to a cognitive stressor that have been through mindfulness-based relapse prevention, standard relapse prevention, or standard aftercare. And we do EEG. I use Power Lab and then Lab Chart to, I do spectral analysis, so just Fourier transform the EEG and look at the power spectrum to assess whether or not we've got respiratory sinus arrhythmia or vagal tone or sympathetic tone. Yeah.
Matthew Ricard, I know he's the most tested individual. Do you know what kind of meditation he does or did? I love Matthew.
I do too.
I just look at his face and he radiates this wonderful presence.
I know.
His face.
When I saw him at a conference, I sat in a room for like 10 minutes after he left, just unable to process. Oh, crud. I just wanted to show you. I put his website on the handout because, there's all kinds of stuff that he does there. But yes, he is an avid compassion meditator, loving-kindness meditator. He was the one that was training the students on compassion meditation. But if his website, you really shouldn't go there. It's beautiful. He's a photographer to boot. So, and it was a geneticist gone monk. So, yeah. I think it's cell geneticist. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
So let's say you have 20 people in a room. How many of them need to be tuned into this stuff to sort of change a room?
Wow, what a great question.
You've
got 20 people in a room. How many people need to be, let's say, attuned or emulating compassion and loving kindness to change the room? I'd say one. Mm-hmm. Given where I work at Seattle Pacific University, you can get one person coming in and they can calm a room. I'm thinking of one person in particular, which I sometimes think is Christ reincarnated, and it really pisses me off because he's my boss. But, you know, they can come in and they can just, the waves settle. And I wonder to what degree these kinds of things generalize in those situations, you know? That's just my thought.
I came in late, so is this going to be up on that MBSR website, these links?
Is that which one it is, Rick?
It will be, yeah.
Okay.
What is the website for that?
You know, I should go get some brochures and things. So why don't I run out and do that? It's just down the hall. But it's all this. And some of the past talk,
here,
some of them that I've been able to remember to record are there as well.
I'm also having my student put them on my website. And so since you came in last, you might have missed that. This is a website that my...
Can't read it.
I know, I'm going to pull it up for you because isn't that terrible?
Yeah, put it on the website.
Let's see if we have internet and it'll go there. No, you have to log on. Okay, so just if you just Google Lustig Lab, where's the pen? Is it okay to write on here? Is that how it works?
Try
it.
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm having flashbacks to my dissertation where I took a permanent marker. Okay. Just my last name's L-U-S as in Sam, T-Y-K. L-U-S as in Sam, T-Y-K. So if you Google Lustig Lab, I'm the first hit. It's a weird name. And this will be on there, and all of my talks are on there with bigger and better brain images and whatnot. So I give them to my clinical students because when they're sitting with patients, sometimes they need a brain image. So help yourself. Take anything you need. And if it's not suitable and you're looking for something else, just email me, contact me. I'm happy to provide you with teaching tools.
I want to put in a plug for Richard's class here. I'm in it, and this gentleman next to me is in it.
And I'm in it.
And you're in it? It is just fantastic, and we're really lucky, I think, to have this kind of training. So I just really recommend it. And when you can get yourself there, it's really fascinating and beautiful.
Great.
It takes about 8 weeks to change your brain, so we've made it for 8 weeks. And there are certain exercises to. You should do functional MRI on us after.
I wouldn't have any more pilot hours they'd be willing to give me.
Actually, I'm in Claudia's. Claudia's doing it on Sunday nights.
Oh.
And Dr. Berger is doing it on Monday mornings, right?
Will that be going on next quarter as well?
Yes, we're probably planning right now on doing it together on Monday mornings.
Monday mornings next quarter?
How many of you are physicians again? There's a physician's training, as you probably know, in mindfulness, but it's out of the UCSD down in California. It has a website to support healthcare providers wanting more resources of how they can be mindful and care for themselves.
That's on the website, too.
Yeah. Joel would link it. But
there are about 17 major universities now that have
that website. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
If it helps, so. It's supposed to help with
your stress, too.